WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After the brilliance of Citizen Kane, Hollywood turned into Orson Welles' worst enemy. Between 1940 and 1958, he would make six studio films, four of which were taken away from him in the editing stage and completely changed. The reworking of Touch of Evil would be the final straw. The great master of Citizen Kane would make other masterpieces, but not for the world to see. Orson Welles came into Hollywood at the end of its golden era, and his aesthetic would threaten the very way the studio system made its movies. Tonight on Point, Orson Welles and his battle with the Hollywood system. Joining me now from Taunton, England, is Clinton Halen, author of Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. Clinton, welcome.
Hi.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, always a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be with you, and hello to our guest.
Clinton, to you first, why is it that we are still so interested in this man, 20 years after his death, 30 years after he got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Film Institute? Why has his life and his work, in particular, inspired yet another book?
Well, essentially, because the work stands up. I mean, Orson Welles didn't imagine that he was making movies that would be forgotten about 3 months after he made them. I think he always realized that his vision went deeper than that. And, you know, I suspect we'll be watching his films as long as movies are shown.
It is fascinating how Citizen Kane is always at or near the top of anyone's best movie list.
Well, indeed, Lady from Shanghai and Touch of Evil seem to be pretty perennial favorites amongst the critics as well. So, considering he only made six movies for Hollywood, and certainly if we had been allowed to see his version of Magnificent Ambersons, I have no doubt that four out of those six films would appear in most people's top 20.
Why did you feel it was necessary to, in essence, set the record straight about him?
Well, I mean, one of the curious things about Welles is that his public persona has kind of got in the way of treating him as a serious artist. And a lot of the biographical studies that have come out in the last, well, since his death in 1985, they've really concentrated on this idea that there was some kind of huge psychological flaw which explains why the movies got taken away from him. And that idea always, disturbed me. It sounded so pat. And so I decided to kind of look into it and see, was that really the case? And of course, as often with these things, a bit like the reporter in Citizen Kane, once I started digging, the story took over.
It sounds as if you probably had a series of eureka moments as you looked at all those notes that he had made for the films that he was seeing in his head before anything ever was photographed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, thankfully, because of the Hollywood system, they kept all the memos and the shooting scripts. And so there is actually a fantastic body of material that one can go after, even down to a 90-page draft for Citizen Kane that predates any of the known shooting scripts, and that all of the people who seem to think that Welles had no hand in that screenplay evidently didn't look at, since it even has his handwritten corrections.
And yet it seems both sad and ironic that many people under the age of 50 who aren't film students or perhaps film buffs perhaps may know him as much for his wine commercials as for his artistic endeavors. Is he the one I remember as intoning that we will serve no wine before it's time?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, obviously, from this side of the pond, that doesn't really mean anything. So, we certainly think of Orson Welles as the filmmaker. But yes, he may have been cursed by that particular means of making ends meet.
Well, exactly. I mean, that must have been something of a come down for him. I assume he was doing it to pay the rent.
Well, yes. I mean, in fairness to Welles, he always did that. I mean, even when he was a success, even when he was the boy wonder kind, He never had any qualms about using his name in order to, you know, line his pocket. So, you know, as he always said, that attitude always mystified him, that it somehow demeaned his work, that he would do an advert for which he would be paid. I mean, the relationship between the two is zero.
Jack, what is your primary memory of him, or how do you look at his life?
Well, Clinton's book actually, I think, is very helpful in making understandable this, well, in sort of unpacking this canard, that namely he had an almost neurotic fear of completion. And that was what the problem was. He just couldn't do these things on time. The schedule went on. The studios finally had to take it away from him. Well, now, understanding what happened to his films when he was finished, one understands he didn't want to finish because then the editors were going to get hold of it and rip it up. You know, it has a, in other words, a functional. We have to understand him as an artist in an industrial system, who didn't want to hand his product to the, you know, to the
Philistines who were going to change it.
That's right.
Do you think there's something of a cautionary tale here as well, Clinton, in terms of the moral being you don't want to peak at age 24?
Oh, I don't think. First of all, let me say, I don't consider that to be his peak. So in that sense, I certainly don't agree with the premise. I think it's just one of those curses that that somebody who has a certain cultural impact when they're young is cursed with that legacy, even though they go on to make more mature work that actually, as an artist, from a purely artistic point of view, is superior, but has nothing like the cultural impact. I mean, you know, I've written extensively on Bob Dylan, who is another person who has been had to drag that ball and chain around. But Dylan's greatest work was not produced when he was 25, but his most influential work was produced when he was 25, and the same curse for Wells.
Well, we've been talking a bit about Orson Welles' masterpiece, Citizen Kane. Let's listen to a little clip of it. We have one of Welles as the young newspaper tycoon Charles Foster Kane. This scene is when he's getting the latest news from a telegram from Cuba, and before he's confronted by his guardian and master financier, Walter Parks Thatcher, who was played by George Koulouris in the film.
Girls, delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
That's fine, Mr. Kane.
Yes, I rather like myself.
Charles, right away.
I came to see you about this campaign of yours. Mm-hmm. It's in quite a campaign against the public transit company.
Mr. Thatcher, do you know anything we could use against them?
Still the college boy, aren't you?
Oh, no, Mr. Thatcher. I was expelled from college. A lot of colleges, you remember. I remember.
So, Clinton Halen, that was the kind of scene that made William Randolph Hearst certainly think that this film was about him. Tell us a little bit about that backstory.
Interestingly, it's interesting that you use that particular clip because obviously William Randolph Hearst wasn't the only person who thought that, because I was actually watching one of the recent James Bond films. And they actually use the exact line from Citizen Kane, which they attribute to Hearst. Hearst never said, "You provide the prose, I'll provide the war." Kane said it. As I say, in this James Bond movie made in the last, 10 years, they have Randolph Hearst saying that line, which he never did. So it shows you the way that kind of acceptance of the idea has taken hold. That never happened. It was fiction. So perhaps Wells succeeded better than he thought. Certainly there are undoubtedly elements of Hearst in the story. Ironically, Wells went to extraordinary lengths to try and lessen the allusions to Hearst that Mankiewicz, his co-writer, had put in there. Wells always felt that it should have a broader brushstroke.
What did Hearst do to try to stop the release of this film, both before it was actually finished and then afterward?
Well, Wells, Hearst himself never actually made any unequivocal statement, stop this film. But he had a lot of people in his organization, which of course was far-reaching, who thought, you know, who took on the role of the soldiers determined to rid Henry II of Thomas of Becket. You know, they took it upon themselves to knock this guy down a peg or two. And when the film actually finally got its premiere, really the battle was over in that sense, because once it was out there, there was no point really in the Hearst Empire taking it on. They'd already done their worst, which was to make sure that other film studios didn't allow it to be shown in their cinemas and so forth.
Jack, a quick last thought here before we have to take a break?
Well, William Randolph Hearst has distinctions. He once employed Hitler to write some articles for him, and he had the greatest movie ever made about him.
Much more to this story. Clearly, we're going to be continuing with that. We're talking this evening about Orson Welles, the movies that he was and was not able to make. My guest is Clinton Halen, author of the new book, Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Orson Welles and his long-fought battle with Hollywood to make the movies he wanted to make. My guest is Clinton Halen, author of the new book, Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. And also with us is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Clinton, how was it that this young man, at age 24, was able to capture Hollywood's attention in the first place? Why was he lured west to begin with?
Well, I mean, you have to understand the context of the time. I mean, the thing is that Welles wasn't alone. You know, there was a huge trawling exercise going on in the 30s by Hollywood. They were everybody under the sun who could write their name with a stick, it seems, was being enticed west. You have writers of the caliber of P.G. Woodhouse and Aldous Huxley, being enticed over the pond. So, Welles was part of that sweeping operation. It's specifically the studio, RKO, had only recently acquired a new head honcho, George Schaefer, and he was looking to make his reputation. And his idea was for the studio to produce fewer, higher quality pictures. And he had his eye on Welles very, very early on.
Even before the War of the Worlds, which certainly brought him to a lot of people's attention.
Yes. Certainly before War of the Worlds. I mean, he'd already made a splash on the New York stage with his Negro Macbeth, and his anti-fascist Julius Caesar. So, you know, he was already being written about. He'd already been on the front cover of Newsweek.
You know. I did not realize that. But certainly the classic story of the Martians landing and how people were going to react made his name even better known. But how was it that he was able to get final cut of Citizen Kane? I mean, at the time, that was unheard of, right?
Oh, it was certainly unheard of. Essentially, the way that he managed to get the kind of control that was never given to Hollywood directors, even experienced ones, was simply by saying no, that he wasn't interested in going to Hollywood, that he wanted to continue to work in the theater, and that, frankly, they were wasting their time talking to him. Now, of course, if you play that hard to get, suddenly these things sometimes happen. Yeah.
And his insistence or his attempt to determine to make sure that nobody could interfere with his vision, I'm assuming that was an aftermath of his radio experience, or at least as you describe it in the book.
Partially. I mean, essentially, Wells didn't suffer from self-doubt as to his abilities. And that extended across a lot of mediums. Ironically, the one field that he really did have doubts about himself was as an actor. But as a director, he doesn't seem to have suffered any great doubts as to his quality and his worth. It never occurred to him to give up control. But certainly his battles with the sponsors of the radio station for his Mercury on the Air certainly inured him to allowing any such control to be given up.
And of course, Jack, one of the other things that Wells was known for is using music in a very different way than anyone had done prior to that. Is that one of the things that lingers in your mind as you think about Wells' contribution?
Well, it does. I mean, and reading this book about his work on Heart of Darkness, he tried to do the Conrad novella. That was going to have a tapestry of sounds, sort of almost going along the river, different sounds for different parts of the river that Marlowe was on. And, of course, the classic music with him, or the most well-known musical sort of raid against him, was in Touch of Evil, which begins with this fabulous shot, little tracking shot of Charlton Heston, the Mexican agent, crossing the border and going into the American town, and all the while the music is playing. And in the version released in the 50s, it's Henry Mancini all the way. But as we discovered in 1998, when the original version, or the version Wells wanted, came out, it was a much more complicated aural beginning.
Exactly, yes. Mancini was pretty innocuous, but not what Wells had in mind. In fact, we have a clip of that, the way Wells wanted it to be, with a much more layered opening, with music sort of going from one sound to the next. Well, certainly Clinton Halen, much more textured than the Mancini score. Was he just beside himself when the studio put in Mancini music for what he had originally wanted for music?
Well, interestingly enough, just to complete that thought, in fact, that idea that he used for Touch of Evil actually dates back to Heart of Darkness, the film that he never got to make, because the opening sequence for Heart of Darkness was meant to do exactly the same thing, except in New York. The camera was meant to pan, and as it went uptown, you would hear different types of music until it went out into the harbor, and the music blended into the foghorn of the ship. So that idea was, in fact, an old idea of Wells. He never abandoned ideas. He stored them away.
Exactly. Recycle them. You never know when you might need them again.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he certainly... one of the things that came across when I went through the material was that he always did try and second guess the studios. He quite correctly realized that they were, that when he delivered these films, that they were likely to be attacked, and he tried to second guess them, and certainly with the with Touch of Evil, he went to great lengths in the very famous 58-page memo to explain why he wanted it done this way, why he didn't want the Mancini score to be used there. Obviously, the score, it was him that got Mancini. It was him, and there was a long discussions between him and Mancini as to the type of music they wanted. So yes, I mean, certainly he was unhappy when they just lopped off his beginning and imposed this other one on.
So was this mostly a story of him fighting to the bitter end and then walking away, or of trying to make it work somehow, or of just essentially folding?
Well, the thing is that you have to see it as a continuity These films keep being taken away from him, and therefore he has to alter his strategies each time this happens. Because Wells kind of starts to examine himself and starts to say, well, is it me? Is it something I'm doing? And so by the time you get to Touch of Evil, which is the last film that he makes for the Hollywood system, he really is played by self-doubt. Whereas with films like Lady from Shanghai or Magnificent Ambersons, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. But those are two films that were literally taken away from him and hacked to pieces. Whereas Touch of Evil, he worked on his own edit. And then, in a rather sneaky studio exercise, he goes off to the Steve Allen show, for 3 days in New York, comes back to find an editor has been put in place. He's not allowed to supervise the editor, and that he basically has to give written instructions to that editor, which may or may not be carried out. And at that point, he realizes it's being taken away from him again, and essentially he has a nervous breakdown, pretty much.
Well, that would certainly make anyone push him over the edge, I would think. I was struck by one of the quotes in the book about Wells saying that any motion picture of consequence is the product of one man. Well, yes, I take his point, but that really isn't how it works in Hollywood. It is a highly collaborative medium.
Oh, he never denied that. He never denied that it was a collaborative medium. What he says, he actually uses the term dominant personality. It doesn't say it was one man. He says one dominant personality. And what he says is that that dominant personality can be the director, it can be the producer, it could be the screenplay writer. It doesn't have to be, per se, the director. In fact, it rarely is. But what he's saying is that the overarching design, the person's, that figure's dominant personality, imbues everything that everyone else does for the movie. And if you watch Citizen Kane, that is the classic example of that. Nobody is arguing that Wells himself couldn't have written the score that Bernard Herrmann wrote for Citizen Kane. But Bernard Herrmann worked closely with Wells and was completely simpatico with Wells' intentions. He worked with him in radio. So exactly the same applies to the art direction by Perry Ferguson and the cinematography by Greg Toland. But they were all, if you can imagine, like a symphony, that Wells is the conductor. And he always understood that idea. He never denied credit to his collaborators. And certainly some of the recent biographers have seemed to imply that that's the case. It's not. In fact, he went out of his way to give credit. If you watch Citizen Kane, you will actually see that Greg Toland's credit is on the same page as Wells' directorial credit. And that was unheard of. Unheard of to give a cinematographer the credit alongside the director.
Well, in the world of Wells as conductor and people who kept pulling pages of the score out without him knowing about it, we've got a couple of clips from Touch of Evil, and that illustrates that point of how the cuts that Hollywood made really did change things. This one, we have two clips. The first one is about Orson Welles, who's playing a bigoted police chief named Hank Quinlan, who frames a young man in Mexico as part of an intricate criminal plot. Charlton Heston is the upright Mexican narcotics investigator Mike Vargas, who clashes with Quinlan and raises suspicions about his past. Here in the studio version is Orson Welles as Hank Quinlan talking with his partner about how his wife was killed.
This is a swell time to be getting fried.
My job's over, Pete. You ought to be over to the park.
Now listen, Hank.
Working on Sanchez. We got to break.
Vargas is telling the chief and the DA that you planted that dynamite.
He was a fool.
They're taking him seriously. They came to him.
No, I mean Sanchez. Dynamite's no way to kill. Did I ever tell you the smart way to kill, Pete?
Sure. Strangle.
Clean. Silent.
You told me all that.
That's
come
how
on,
my wife
finish
died.
The coffee.
I don't usually talk about my wife.
Never when you're sober.
She was strangled, Pete.
I know.
Bind and cord. She was working up at the packing plant, so the killer had it right to hand. Smart. You don't leave fingerprints on a piece of string.
Bartender, what do I owe you?
That half-breed done it, of course. We all knew
La
that,
Quinta.
But I was just a rookie cop.
475.
I followed around after him, my heart out, trying to catch him.
So that's the part that made it into the final draft of Touch of Evil. But the studio took out a lot of the vision that Orson Welles had in there about the dynamic between Quinlan and Mike Vargas, the corrupt cop versus the idealist. So in 1998, when there was a restored version of Touch of Evil, there is this additional exchange between Quinlan and Vargas.
Quiet little tea party, all for Rudy Lennox's bonfire. Yeah, I hear he even invited some kind of a Mexican.
Oh, I don't think Mr. Vargas claims any jurisdiction.
I should hope not. Two people, Americans, have blown to hash with dynamite practically in my own police station.
I wonder, what makes you so very sure it was dynamite?
My leg.
Your what?
His game leg. Sometimes he gets a kind of a twinge like folks do for a change of weather. Intuition, he calls it.
Vargas has a theory that the murder itself was committed outside of our jurisdiction.
Of course, we're all of us going to cooperate.
Don't worry, Captain. I'm merely what the United Nations would call an observer.
I don't talk like one, I'll say that for you. Mexican, I mean.
Captain, you won't have any trouble with me.
You bet your sweet life I won't.
Clinton Halen, was that part of the problem, that Welles really wanted to tell the whole story? He wanted the backstory, he wanted the front story, he wanted to really dig deeply into these characters, and the studio just basically, what, didn't have the time for it?
Well, the problem essentially was that they just did not understand what he was trying to do. Now, one of the things that certainly plagued him in those years was that the producers and the studio chiefs that he was dealing with don't actually seem to have read the screenplays he delivered, because certainly in the case of Touch of Evil and certainly in the case of The Magnificent Ambersons, he deviated very little from the shooting scripts that the studios had. So the darkness of both of those films is there in the shooting script. Essentially, the studios just weren't used to somebody as painstaking and didn't really understand the way that everything interconnected in Welles' vision. In other words, to them, a film is completely linear, that there is no conception that, scene 16 relates back to scene 7 and without it, it makes no sense, and that connects with scene 8, and, the garbage blowing around in the wind is actually symbolic. It means something other than just garbage. And all of those ideas, Welles worked out from a central kernel. And I genuinely believe that the complexity of his vision was just too much for them.
And Jack Beatty, what do you make of that? I mean, you have been both an author and an editor. Can you think of a way that Welles might have been able to accomplish his vision perhaps better than he was able to?
Well, they say that John Ford got more of his control over his movies by really just being parsimonious in his shooting. I mean, he gave the studio essentially no leeway in the film that he gave them. In other words, he didn't give them a longer thing that they had to cut down. There was nothing like that. He just tried to do it, almost force it on them by saying, well, that's all we've got. All the actors have gone home and so on. And yet recently, My Darling Clementine was re-released, and sure enough, he didn't do it successfully, because the studio had cut out several little bits, one that was more like what Clinton says about texture. It was just a talk between Wyatt Earp and somebody in the sheriff of this town. And between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, but a key linkage in the whole plot was just washed away by the studio, and they changed the sequence. And so even Ford, who just basically gave them almost to the minute film, he couldn't even avoid being messed around with like that.
Well, that is a fascinating concept. You want a 90-minute film? Here it is.
You know, 92
not
minutes.
98 that you're going to be able to cut
right.
3 minutes out of.
Right.
All right, gentlemen, stay with us. We're going to continue in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the legendary Orson Welles, his life, his career, and how it might have been different. My guest is Clinton Halen, author of the new book, Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Orson Welles with Clinton Halen, author of the new book, Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. And also with us is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hollywood is the kind of place where people love it if you succeed, and perhaps they love it even more when you fail. By the time Welles started Citizen Kane, Clinton Halen, is it fair to say there were a number of people rooting for him to fail?
Oh, from day one. I mean, you know, he landed in Hollywood in July of 1939, and he didn't start work on Kane for another almost a year. In that whole time, the Hollywood scandal columns took great delight in pouring scorn on his plans and, you know, referring to his movies as Welles' latest first movie. So, yes, there was an enormous amount of jealousy. Ironically, not really from the directors, or certainly not from the directors that he really admired. Obviously, Hitchcock had just arrived. Preston Sturges was finally getting to make his first film. Not so much from them, much more from the people who seemed far more threatened, the people who were compliant, if you like, in the way that Hollywood worked.
And as you tell us in the book, he was the first to use a first-person narrative that was later used by Hitchcock when he made Rebecca. How was he a great experimenter in terms of how he told a story?
Well, of course, one of the things that he did bring to Hollywood was his extraordinary radio experience. Up to that point, the soundtrack, not just the music, but the way that overlapping dialogue and so forth, the soundtrack was considered completely secondary to the important stuff that was on the screen. Welles built his films from the ground up, and he always considered the soundtrack central. This constant use of overlapping dialogue and sophisticated use of fade-ins and fade-outs and music blending into conversation. So certainly that was extremely radical. And it was the one field that no one could argue with Welles about because he already had unquestioning credentials.
Clearly. And yet he was also doing much more than radio set to pictures, because when you think about his visual sense, we have another clip that I want to play, and then let's reflect on its meaning as well and its contribution to his work. This is the famous Hall of Mirrors sequence at the end of the 1947 film The Lady from Shanghai. We have Everett Sloan as the crippled husband, Arthur Bannister, who's confronting his young wife, a blonde, Rita Hayworth, and her lover, Michael O'Hara, who is played by Orson Welles.
I presume you think that if you murder me here,
your sailor friend will get the blame.
You'll be free to spend my money. Well, dear, you aren't the only one who wants me to die.
Our good friend, the district attorney, is just itching to open a letter that I left with him. The letter tells all about you, lover.
So you'd be foolish to fire that gun. With these mirrors, it's difficult to tell. You are aiming at me, aren't you?
I'm aiming at you, lover.
Of course, killing you is killing myself. It's the same thing. But you know, I'm pretty tired of both of us.
Brilliant. Mirrors, you know, what did that add, Clinton?
It's just an extraordinary visual tour de force. No one else would have done that and certainly shot it that way. And one of the great things about the Hall of Mirrors shootout is that the person watching the movie's perspective is never made absolutely clear. In other words, if you actually did have a shootout in the Hall of Mirrors, it wouldn't look like that. But at no point do you feel that. At no point do you suspend your disbelief. It feels absolutely visceral. You feel you are there. And of course, the final shot where the last pane of glass falls, and we realize that, in fact, Elsa, Rita Hayworth, has indeed been mortally wounded herself, is just a superb way to bring the film to its climax. These sharks feeding off each other.
It certainly makes for a terrifying scene. Jack Beatty, help us understand the other context of Welles' work. He certainly had a very complicated personal life as well.
Yes. I don't know the number of his wives, but it was a, you know, he could raise a quorum there anytime he wanted.
Perhaps not all of them in the same room.
No, or even with him. You know, I think that his growing corpulence over the years to many seemed to be pat and facile, but nevertheless inevitable sort of symbol of a man letting himself go, a talent gone slack, somebody who had been, you know, just sort of almost corrupted by the system. And he became, in that sense, kind of a parody of himself. And I do think there's something to it that, you know, he was a perfectionist with some of these movies. And just reading about these shots in that he tried to get in Clinton's book, I mean, you realize, well, if you're a businessman making a movie and your director keeps sending you in these complicated and expensive and time-consuming takes and camera angles and so on, you're in a real conflict with the business part of it. You're the he was more like a novelist in a film in an industry. You can't be a novelist in the film industry. It's an industry.
There is another great quote from the book about how his Welles' perpetual dissatisfaction was his undoing, his perpetual craving for perfection. And I wonder, Clinton Halen, if you see that playing out in his personal life as well, and this whole issue about his search for perfection being with other people's money. I mean, that does get expensive with no guarantee of a return for them.
Well, again, one of the kind of the myths that has built up around Welles suggests that he was a profligate director. That certainly wasn't the case. The irony of it is that, you know, Citizen Kane was made for less money than a Michael Jackson video. Let's put this in perspective. Where he became time-consuming and painstaking in his methodology was in the editing suite, which essentially isn't an expensive exercise. It obviously creates delays in terms of the finishing of the work. So studios weren't used to somebody who wanted to spend a year editing a movie. They expected a movie to be edited in 2 months. You know, he only ever went significantly over budget on one film, and that was Lady from Shanghai. And essentially, he went over budget there because the owner of the studio, Harry Cohn, kept forcing him to rewrite the script because he didn't like the endings that Welles kept coming up with. So, ironically, if Welles had been left alone and delivered the movie he wanted to make all along, which is effectively a modern version of Carmen, he would have been pretty close to delivering on budget. And as I say, that's really the only film where he goes significantly over budget. And it's the only film that he ever made that cost much more than $1 million.
Well, if in fact he was a genius, as many people believe he was, does that account for some of the problems he experienced in his personal life, in your view?
I'm not sure what the problems in his personal life were, if I can put it in those terms. I mean, he was certainly a ladies' man. There's no question that he found monogamy extremely difficult. All three of his marriages were, I guess, failures. Certainly he considered them failures. But he had an extraordinary joie de vivre. And despite his problems with his weight, which he'd always had, which obviously became problematic towards the end of his life, problematic in the sense that it made it difficult for him to make a living as an actor because he physically wasn't up to it. His back, he was having serious back pains. He couldn't shoot for a day. You know, he would end up breaking something, which is really why he fades out of films as an actor in the last decade, and probably the last two decades of his life. But he never allowed that to get him down. He died at the age of 70. He did a national TV interview with Merv Griffin the night that he died. He did, and was still completely on the ball, witty, his usual bon vivant self. He died of a heart attack when he went home that night. So the portrait of him as some kind of great tragic figure, I think is a projection. I think it's other people wanting to make him into that figure.
Well, it is a fascinating figure indeed. You've given us a very insightful look at his work. Clinton Halen, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Clinton Halen, author of Despite the System, Orson Welles versus the Hollywood Studios. And Jack Beatty, with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News Analyst, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined again by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, but first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
This is not the behavior that should be endorsed as the face of the United States to the world community in the United Nations. Rather, Mr. Chairman, it is my opinion that John Bolton is the poster child of what someone in the diplomatic corps should not be.
The event this morning shows two things. One, that Afghanistan is a democratic state. Two, that Afghanistan as a democratic state is not yet ready with the institutions to handle it.
Violence has continued throughout the province, even outside of the Western operation that's going on right now. Three U.S. Marines were killed on Monday in the province.
The mission is to eliminate insurgents and foreign fighters in this region that's known for its smuggling and as a recent location for foreign fighters and insurgents.
You are building a democratic society where the rights of minorities are respected, where a free press flourishes, a vigorous opposition is welcome, and unity is achieved through peace.
We are recommending the closure of 33 of the 318 major military installations in the United States and the realigning of 29 more.
The plane in the air did not appear to be hostile. It was a very slow-moving Cessna. Individual judgments were made as to who should be evacuated and who should not be evacuated. And based on what we learned around 9/11, we always know the Secret Service uses an abundance of caution.
Republican Senator George Voinovich of Ohio rips into President Bush's nominee for UN Ambassador John Bolton, but the nomination still made it out of committee. Afghans take to the streets in mass protests after reports claim that interrogators at Guantanamo Bay had flushed a Quran down the toilet. Another round of deadly bombings in Iraq as the U.S. begins a new offensive against insurgents near the Syrian border. President Bush praises the people of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia during a visit there. The Pentagon recommends the closing of hundreds of military installations, including 33 major bases. And a small plane flies deep into restricted airspace, prompting an evacuation of the Capitol, White House, and Supreme Court. Jack Beatty, again, another busy news week. Which of those events strikes you first?
Well, I watched some of the Bolton hearings, and he was as Assistant Secretary of State with the arms control portfolio. He was kind of the anti-arms control Assistant Secretary, and he's going to be the anti-diplomat if he gets to the to the UN. And you know, in politics, they all indulge hyperbole, but boy, when those Republican senators had to say he's the best man for the job, you knew they must have been just feeling, boy, the things you're going got to do to keep your job.
And yet, you know, many Republicans do not like him either.
Oh, I know. And it's going to be tough for, I mean, George Voinovich deserves a lot of credit. It was a profile in courage to come out against your president's, nominee for a high position. But these people in the middle, these Republican senators, have got to pick their fights. Are they going to fight with the White House and the leadership on Bolton by voting against Bolton on the floor? Or are they going to fight with the leadership on when it comes to voting to end the filibuster? If Senator Frist follows through with his nuclear option, and they're going to have to pick one or the other. You don't want to be doing both of them, because that really would hurt. And it hurts in this way. I mean, Trent Lott was talking about the senator from Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee, and he said, well, you know, Link Chafee is running for re-election, and boy, we don't know whether we can find any money for him up there if he's not going to, you know, play ball with us. And Lincoln Chafee doesn't have much money.
And what about these reports coming out of Guantanamo Bay? Again, these reports are claims. They have not been confirmed. But you have to wonder if there is anything that could have been more offensive than this notion of flushing a Quran down the toilet.
Yes, and it fits into a pattern of things that really show us an unlovely face of our military. One of the other things they did there was to have a woman, maybe several, but I read of one at least, in her bra and panties, essentially interviewing these Muslim men who are, can you imagine it, actually modest, and who don't regard that as at all, it's just something that's unthinkable to them to be around a woman to whom they're not married when she's not properly dressed. And they played on this diabolically, on these men's modesty, on their, you know, their cultural norms to just undo them. I mean, it's just devilish. And you know, speaking of devilish, according to Human Rights Watch, we have sent to Egypt dozens, since 2001, dozens of prisoners to be tortured there. Our government is doing that. We're sending people we capture to Egypt so that the Egyptians can torture them to see if they can get something out of them. I tell you, what can one say?
Well, all of that notwithstanding, Jack, hope you have a nice weekend.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Jim Moses and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.